I love to create, whether it's businesses, books, art, whatever it may be. That's kind of what I'm here for.
Welcome to this Epic Life podcast. My name is Christopher Carter, founder and chief of, well, my epic life anyway. This epic life is a spiritual catalyst for individuals and culture catalyst for business. We're constantly looking at ways to reframe events into revolutionary experiences. That could be in our families or homes, throughout our careers and beyond. Our featured guest on the podcast today is power entrepreneur and shapeshifter Jonathan Fields. Jonathan is the author of a couple amazing books, Uncertainty, Turning Fear and Doubt into Fuel for Brilliance, as well as Career Renegade. He most recently launched a broadcast quality web series called Good Life Project. Today we'll discuss the origin of Jonathan's mindset and how his daily mindfulness practice anchored him through his career as an entrepreneur, author, and family man. Then we'll take a look at how he balances a truly inspired work life with his family. And we'll finish with a look behind the scenes of his latest adventure with the Good Life Project. I'm really excited to share this conversation. Large sections of it absolutely gave me the chills. This Epic Life welcomes Jonathan Fields.
I know I've prepared you a little bit for what we're going to talk about today, but you know, basically I've identified a bit of a knowledge gap when it comes to your brand. A lot of people know your wild journey from lawyer to fitness trainer to entrepreneur, yoga magnate, to blogger, author, speaker, now producer and founder of Good Life Project. Today I thought it'd be cool to talk about kind of what powers that unique brand of wild journey. So what kind of mindset did you have when you got started, and how did it evolve as you developed through those different stages of your career?
That is an interesting question. Well, when you say when I got started, when are you talking about?
Oh, I'm talking about the leap from crazy frazzled New York City lawyer to personal trainer.
I mean, it was interesting. I was in a place where when I was a lawyer, I was kind of a disaster. So, you know, when you're working crazy hours and taking terrible care of yourself, both physically and emotionally, and just pouring everything you have into the work, it's very hard to be able to think clear. So I knew that about 9 months before I left, I'd ended up in the hospital in emergency surgery. Mm-hmm. That was a big wake-up call, but I wasn't exactly sure what my next move would be. But I knew I was leaving the law at that point. So I started to make a list of the things I thought would be cool to do. And I started to save money, because a lot of the things on that list were not things that were going to make me a whole lot of money. But here's where it really gets to your question. I also knew that by the time I was ready to leave, I was in such a bad place from a mindset standpoint that I couldn't make a rational decision from the place that I was in. Mm-hmm. So I took a brief leave of absence, and I remember being so nervous walking into the, you know, senior partner's office saying, hey, listen, I need to take some time. So what started as, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks of a leave of absence, and that just gave me the space to step back and to recover a bit and to, you know, take care of myself for a few weeks and sleep and de-stress a little and get my mindset in a place where I was actually capable of making some sort of intelligent decision. Because I knew if I had made a decision sort of from the depths of where I was, it probably wouldn't be a good decision.
I always liken it to being kind of down in the maze where you could only see 5 to 10 feet in front of you in different walls and corners, to the difference of being kind of up above it and looking at different angles and landscapes and things. And I feel like at every stage of your career, you've gotten kind of further above that maze a bit. I'm at a point now where I met you for the first time back in March, and I can't imagine you in kind of a frazzled mindset.
And you know, it's funny because I have sort of like part of my brand is being, you know, Mr. Chill, that I'm very calm and relaxed and on the surface. But there are times where there's a firestorm, you know, spinning inside my head. And, you know, when I launched my last book, I did the insane thing of launching a book and relaunching a product, like substantial business product at the same time, which was just, honestly, just plain stupid, but it had to be done.
So that was, that was Tribal Author and Uncertainty at the same time, right?
Right. So that was a little bit nuts. But because of the way that the calendar was working out, we just had to push forward. So there's no doubt, there's times where on the inside, there's a lot of storming going on. Mm-hmm. But I mean, over the years, I've developed practices that allow me to zoom the lens out the way you described it. You know, sometimes in the beginning as a lawyer, I had to physically do that. I had to physically remove myself from what I was doing. These days, I've developed daily practices that allow me to do that on a smaller basis every day and you get this sort of collective ability. It helps you build the ability to just keep zooming the lens out. I mean, when you're talking about meditation, it's really, my practice is mindfulness, and it operates on two levels. One is training attention. That's basically, training where you're focusing awareness. But the other is training something called meta attention, which is an awareness of where you're focusing your awareness.
Right.
And that's the thing that allows you to sort of like pull back out of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you're looking down and seeing where you're thinking and what you're doing, and then adjust course a lot more sort of deliberately.
It actually explains why someone would be crazy enough to release a book simultaneously with a product about how to release a book, because you are so meta, you don't even know how meta you are. I was actually going to ask you about your current practice, and that was one of the surprising things when I got into, I discovered your work through the Uncertainty book. What really hooked me in was, like leaning into uncertainty and using it as fuel for creative brilliance, all that stuff. But what really kind of kept me in it was in the middle of the book, you go really deep into mindfulness, pretty long, substantial chapter, overview a lot of all the different methods and practices. What's your current mindfulness practice and how much time do you put in each day?
So for me, it's a combination of stuff. I mean, I roll out of bed and the first thing I do is I sit for 25 minutes every morning like clockwork. Doesn't matter if I'm on the road, doesn't matter where I am, doesn't matter if there's a lot of stuff going on around me. I'm usually the first one up in my house, so there's a small window where it's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sit and I do 5 minutes of breath work, and then I do 20 minutes. It just moves into 20 minutes of a very simple breath oriented mindfulness practice. So that's my daily sitting practice. And then from there, mindfulness can be a meditation, a sitting meditation, but it's also a way of looking at the world. It's a practice of living in the world, of trying to be present, trying to bring your attention. So I find myself on a regular basis just kind of pulling back for 30 seconds at a time all day long, and looking at what's really in front of me. It's a beautiful day. Like, just stop what I'm doing and just participate in the breeze and the sun and the sounds around me. If I see my daughter doing homework across the room, rather than me just working, I'll just look up and watch her for, 30 seconds or a minute and just, observe. So it's also just about how you move throughout your day.
Yeah, I talk about that in terms of, the lens and the filters you see the world through are kind of cultivated over time. You don't just wake up one day and all of a sudden you're like this. You know how to view your kids and your life in a certain light. It develops through this practice of silence and attention. I see pictures that you post on social media. Like, I'm looking at it through your eyes in the sense that simple, seemingly ordinary events become kind of revolutionary when you view them in that kind of filter.
And what's kind of funny about that is we're actually in the middle of a total rebrand and redesign for my website.
Mm-hmm.
And when it goes up, I'll be launching some new sort of segments too. And part of the redesign is to remove a huge amount of clutter and distraction from the site, make it super streamlined and zenny. And then one of the new features that we'll be adding in is a feature called Through My Eyes.
Ooh.
Where it's just images and sometimes videos. And it's just because this is kind of fascinating. So just over the last year or two, I've become really fascinated with photography on a total hack level. But I'm somebody who's been told since I was fairly young that I look at the world differently.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean better. It just means differently.
You're an artist too. You kind of make mention of it in Uncertainty a little bit, but you were a painter as a kid and also a musician.
Yeah. So, I've always kind of looked at it through my lens using your language. And for some reason, at different times, sometimes people enjoy that lens, or people, I think sometimes too, as a writer, people are curious about the lens that I view the world through, because I tend to write about topics that a lot of people write about, but with a different lens and a different take on them.
Yeah.
So I've been really interested in how that manifests in taking photos. So it's funny, like, I'll look at something and I'll just see it at a different angle and I'll take a picture. And then I'll also see what I can do to the image. How can I, if I bumped up colors in it or if I did this to it. Yeah, I mean, like, you've noticed, I'll share those things on Instagram or online or some, and people seem to enjoy it. So I figured, why not just sort of create a new segment, and that's just kind of like a little bit more, hey, this is the way I see the world visually. And I'm having a ball doing it, so.
I'm kind of spoiled because I get to work with you in Good Life Project. That first session we did in New York City, the first base camp, we did a group meditation practice with Amelia, yeah. who runs the mindset portion. I was kind of just sitting there in a total full Zen bliss, and you walk up with your cell phone and just snap a picture of me. It's usually such a personal thing, you know, but we're in this group setting, and you're like, I got to take a picture. I see something here. You took a picture. And you emailed it to me, you know, a few days later. And when I saw that picture, there's something that comes through it that's kind of beyond me. It's more so I feel in tune, I feel in sync, I feel within my power. But obviously you were able to see something in that through the lens. It was really cool. That picture I could use for a lot of things now because it reminds me of what I'm aspiring to.
Yeah, you know, when I took that picture, it's just I was looking at you and set against this like really interesting backdrop of light.
Yeah,
and
the setting had a lot to do with it. It wasn't just me or my hair or my outfit. The whole vibe of the room was incredible.
It was your fabulous good looks.
Yeah, and, my like, angular jaw. Yeah.
Right, but there was just something about it. And again, that's not to say like I'm any better at seeing things, or it's just everybody sees the world in their own special way, and it's nice to be able to start to figure out ways to capture that and share it with people. And if it resonates with people, it's awesome. It's another way to connect.
No, I can't wait to see that portion of your site. That's going to be awesome. In terms of your mindfulness practice, how did building and running Sonic Yoga and kind of getting really deep into the whole yoga thing influence your mindfulness practice?
Yeah, I mean, it was huge. I'm always been somebody who's been very fascinated by the mind-body connection my whole life. I've always done a fair amount of research on the way the body works, the way the mind works, and it was always touch and go, whether I was going to go to law school or physical therapy school or get a PhD in psychology. So oddly enough, I did the one which was probably the least in sync with who I am. So it's been a lot of
it helped. It contributed to, you know, a lot of things.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, yeah, I mean, owning a yoga studio and, you know, for 7 amazing years in New York City and being able to do a really deep dive into Eastern philosophy, especially Buddhism, Shambhala Buddhism, has been huge for me. It's, you know, I created a business that allowed me to spend a lot of time going deep into philosophy, into Eastern philosophy in particular, which is all fundamentally, you know, all of yoga, all the physical practices are largely there to heal, strengthen, and still your body so that you can go deeper into the meditative side of the practice.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of people in the U.S. at least don't actually practice it that way.
Like recently you told me that, you know, I know you had far less turnover with your staff and stuff. You did a lot to train yoga instructors, and as a result, they stuck around a lot longer than the average person in that industry does. And I'm sure that kind of approach like filtered out to the staff as well.
It did. We started a teacher training school basically at the same time that we opened the studio because we knew that we were having trouble. Yeah, I was having trouble finding the type of teachers that I wanted to have represent the business.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, okay, if I'm having trouble finding them, then I need to train them. From the very beginning, we had a really strong tradition, and we ended up building probably one of the largest teacher training schools on the East Coast, if not the country.
That's the best part I love about your story, is that you come out, you're a lawyer, I think I'll be a personal trainer. You're a personal trainer, I think I'll open a yoga studio. And then, you know, within a couple of weeks after 9/11, you're actually teaching yoga yourself, probably teaching yoga to yourself as you teach it to other people.
Totally. And it's kind of funny because, you know, like, by all rights, I shouldn't have been teaching yoga, but there were two of us, and I'm an entrepreneur. I had no following. I had no reputation. I'd never taught a yoga class before. So what I actually did was a couple of weeks before we actually launched, I went out and I bought the top-selling yoga videos, and I memorized all the routines.
I pictured the scene in Napoleon Dynamite where he pops in that VHS tape of the dance moves and he just works it out in his bedroom. Was it kind of like that?
It pretty much. And literally for the first 3 to 6 months, you know, like one day I was Rodney Yee, one day I was Baron Baptiste, one day I was Anna Forrest. You know, and I figured, okay, you know, these are really well tested, you know, yoga sequences. And you know, then I had a partner also who was a much more advanced practitioner and a real teacher. And over time, I studied a lot more and became certified, and then we learned to teach. But yeah, I mean, from a mindset standpoint, in terms of jumping in, I've always been of the mindset, let's just get it rolling and then I'll figure it out along the way.
So I wanted to shift gears a little bit, and I'm not going to Barbara Walters you here, I swear. You were actually invited to speak at the Dad 2.0 Summit in Austin this year, and I wanted to find out, I've never had a chance to ask you, like, what kind of stuff do you cover there? What was your agenda?
It was the inaugural year of the Dad 2.0 Summit in Austin, so I was the opening keynote, so it was a nice honor. And I was really talking about embracing the uncertainty of building a career while being a dad, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a really interesting dynamic because to a large extent, culture still looks at dads as being, well, you know, you've got to be the rock in the family and you've got to provide stability and security and, you know, you're the one to look to and everyone wants to know it's okay. And that is not necessarily true. I mean, women... Right. The women in my life are hands down way more powerful. And
look at season one of the Good Life Project that we're in right now. The women in the group are
right.
Staggeringly powerful.
Unbelievable. But there is this big societal construct around it. And as a dad from the inside out, you do want to feel like, you know, I'm taking care of my family. They're looking to me, my daughter's eyes look up and I want her to know that, you know, things would be okay. But at the same time, I love to create, whether it's businesses, books, art, whatever it may be. That's kind of what I'm here for.
Yeah.
And a big part of that process is consistently taking action in the face of the unknown.
Right.
And, you know, so which means I have to take risks. You know, I have to take risks of myself on a, you know, exposing who I am level, on a financial level.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this really interesting dynamic.
I mean, the time alone... When you're a creator, you need to create space around that time so you actually create, you know, good solid output.
Right. Absolutely. So it's this dance, which is really interesting, between really needing to honor that, because if you don't, you start to wither and then you can't play the role that you need to play the role because you're not who you are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you want to be there and take care of your family and make sure everyone's okay. So there's no easy answer to that equation.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's really important to have a more public conversation about it among dads, especially because more and more dads that I've seen are sort of walking away from the old construct of just, you know, sort of shut up on your living. Nobody told you had a right to be happy.
Yeah.
And they're starting to say, you know what? I actually want to be really involved in the life of, you know, like my partner, my spouse, my kids.
Yeah.
And I actually want to do something that's meaningful in the world. And I believe it can be done. So, you know, how do we do this? And there's a lot of confusion, a lot of anxiety, and we're just largely not trained to handle it all that effectively.
We continually say that the reason I do all these things, the reason I have to express and build community, build whatever it is for my family. I think the best example you could really show your kid is that you're capable of expressing yourself and building a community around that and doing these things. But it's far outside of the norm that we grew up with.
My wife's grandfather was a shoe salesman in Mills in New York City for, you know, 40 something years until the day he retired and got his pension. That's what he did for life. And I remember when I left law, you know, almost to the day that, you know, from that moment on, like he would always, when we saw him, see, he would ask some variation of, you know, so are you ready to go back to law now?
Right.
Just because it wasn't conceivable, you know, like people of his generation, this isn't what it was about. He was a Great Depression person.
Mm-hmm.
And happiness, getting meaning and happiness and, you know, soul out of your work, it was so far out of what it was about, you know. And when he was growing up, it was about, you know, we don't know if we're going to have a roof over our head or food on the table.
Yeah, it was a scarcity mentality.
Right. And there was real, real, real intensity of scarcity then.
You sure,
to honor
sure.
that. It wasn't about, you know, when in the middle of the Great Depression, you're not running around saying, I need to do something more meaningful with my life when you've got, you know, mouths to feed. You know, the world has evolved since then. And we have an opportunity to bring a different orientation to the work that we do. But there are a lot of people that still have come up through so many generations that operate under the same assumptions that those generations have operated under, that it's also really difficult to find a like-minded group of people to support the way that you want to live your life and build your career, you know, which is one of the reasons why I've started, you know, sort of building what I'm building this year. create those communities.
Yeah. And I want to get into that. But right before we do, who's your, you know, in terms of mentors or heroes on the dad 2.0 or 3.0 front, is there anybody that comes to mind in your circle that just rocks it in terms of being a dad and managing a big ass enterprise?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and I'm going to freak you out and say no. And
mind blown.
Yeah, and here's why. And this has been an exploration of mine for a number of years now, and maybe the focus of my next book, I'm not sure. There is an extremely difficult challenge in trying to grow what you call the big ass enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And being a really present dad.
Yeah.
I've known a lot of people, and I know a lot of dads who are great husbands and great dads and are sitting on top of tremendous, tremendous businesses or bodies of work or movements. But almost to the one, if you trace back into their history, it's a second marriage, or it's a marriage that's been repaired, and it's a relationship with the kids that's been blown apart and then repaired with a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
It's exceedingly difficult to grow something world-class great, to grow something truly, truly extraordinary, and at the same time, you know, to scale it into, you know, something really big, and at the same time, to be an extraordinarily present dad and husband.
Well, as you document what you're doing and develop a how-to manual, I will pre-order that thing right now.
A big part of what I'm doing right now behind the scenes and what I'm building is I'm trying to figure out how can I scale something that allows me to just have a blast doing it, feel like it's deeply meaningful. But at the same time, how can I scale for maximum impact and minimum complexity so that I maintain the space in my life to be deeply present in the life of my family along the way.
Well, let's talk about the current project. So with Good Life Project, you started announcing it in your annual report in December, and it launched in February, I believe. And then the base camp started launching in March. You know, as a participant in that, kind of the most shocking extra value that I was not planning on at all in the format of the meeting was really what created a lot of power, you know? So can you talk about what went into the design of that, like creating the circle of champions, as you call it, and, you know, the selection of those people to lean on each other?
You know, one of the huge missing pieces, like we were talking about earlier, in your ability to succeed is social support. It's, you know, one of the biggest, and one of the reasons why I started this, the venture, was that over the years, so many people have come to me and said, you know, I love what you're doing. I would love to start to do things like this in my own life, but I can't find community. I can't find like-minded people to talk to share with, to support me, to inspire me, to learn from.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to create that, but it was really important from day one. The last thing I want to do is make people reliant on me.
Solely.
You know, it was really important to me to do a lot of work to foster really deep relationships within the group so that at the end of this 10-month immersion, when everybody graduates, you have this extraordinary group of champions that you'll move forward with for the rest of your life.
I've taken that back to the company that I work for, a tech company, and started to run my meetings with my team that way, where, you know, we each share a piece of our story, and then we start figuring out really quickly how to lean on each other, just because I'm not around all the times, and it's not just about the manager and the group leader running things. It becomes really powerful. I took a break from work and I, like a sabbatical, I come back and the team is so incredibly tight. It's really inspiring, but that's definitely from the Good Life Project format.
And I love seeing it. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to structure it that way, because I love the fact that you're taking that format and then moving it out. And it really is powerful. And it was so important for me to start to, from day one, also like use that format to help people realize that you don't have to look to me for answers. I'm here to help. I'm here to give answers. But there's so much within each of the people in the group. And it's funny, one of the selection criteria, because a lot of people ask me, well, how did I choose these 15 people? One of the single biggest things for me was I was looking for people where in the application and in the question where I asked, what are you looking to get out of this experience? Part of what they said in some language was, I'm looking to give to the group, because I wanted people in the group who are there to help build all the other people as well.
But yeah, congrats on building something so freaking cool, Jonathan Fields. Again, can you give us a little sneak preview on what to expect out of the content engine in the coming weeks as we wrap up here?
behind the scenes for the last 3 months, we've been actually in production on a broadcast quality web show, a 45-minute interview, sort of Charlie Rose style web show shot with a real crew on location, with just some amazing people. And the goal is to tell the stories of mission-driven people who are building extraordinary businesses, bodies of work, or movements, and then also bring in content experts who are some of the top people in the world and what they know, and share their expertise on mindset, psychology, business, whatever it may be. And there's sort of a subtler thing behind it, which is that I've been really frustrated with, you know, with an 11-year-old daughter. I hate the fact that mainstream media does such a horrible job of telling the stories of extraordinary women in the world. So I kind of figured, you know, if they're not doing it, then I need to be part of the solution. I need to be the one who's out there telling the stories.
Yeah.
So we're, you know, at least 50% of the content of the interviews are going to be women, which is really unusual for a show that's got a really strong focus on entrepreneurship. It tends to be a very male-heavy area, and I really want to change that dynamic.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I feel like we dove into more than I planned on, but it was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Always my pleasure. Lots of gratitude for allowing me to stay and have a conversation with you.
We hope you've enjoyed this installment of This Epic Life podcast. For more information on Jonathan's latest projects, visit jonathanfields.com or goodlifeproject.com. Please be sure to share feedback or questions on the site at thisepiclife.com or send me a fax to kc@thisepiclife. Just be sure you scan it before you email it. Sign up for updates either on the site or on Twitter. We're interviewing singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco in an upcoming episode, as well as a steady stream of world-changing badasses in business, art, music, and beyond. The podcast will be available for subscription soon on iTunes. In the meantime, just please keep checking back. My name is KC. Please be sure to remember who you are and honor all that unique magic stirring around inside of you. Namaste.